Hello, Lopez. I'm Lorna Reese, and I'm here today for the Lopez Writers Guild with a brand new radio show, Lopez Writers Read. Those of you who have attended any of our Writers Read evenings at Lopez Center know you have a real treat in store for you, because we'll be bringing you your friends and neighbors reading from their own writing work. In each program, we'll talk to the writers about their work and their process, and they'll read a couple of pieces to us as well. This program, this first one, is pre-recorded on April 22nd. Our first interviewee today is, our first interviewee on the show is Iris Gravel. As a nurse, Iris Gravel loved listening to the stories of patients in hospital rooms, exam rooms, and private homes. 25 years later, she now gives voice to the untold stories of ordinary people, homesteaders in Mexico, hurricane survivors in Nicaragua, senior citizens in her rural community, and in her recently published book, Those Who Work With Their Hands. Iris's interview, essay, and memoir pieces have been published in national and regional journals and magazines. Let's talk about your book, Hands at Work. Hands at Work, Portraits and Profiles of People Who Work With Their Hands. Where did this idea originate, Iris?
The idea for the book originated with an exhibit of black and white photographs by Summer Moon Scriver in 2004. Summer and I are part of the Chimera Artists Cooperative, and Summer had a show at the gallery. And all the photographs were of people's hands doing lots of different things. But the ones that really struck me and spoke to me were the hands that were doing some kind of work. As a writer, I wanted to give voice to those stories that I knew were there in the images. And since I use words, I wanted to have some words to go along with those images. So I rather naively approached Summer and said, Summer, what if we collaborated and we did a book about people who work with their hands and do some more, get some more photographs, and I'll interview people and write stories. And I think Summer was just as naive as I was about what that might involve, but fortunately she agreed, and that really began our collaboration.
Why do you call it naive?
Well, of course, now, 4 years later, we both know much more about what's involved with writing a book, doing the photography, and since we chose to self-publish, there's that whole additional aspect that's another whole discipline besides writing and photography that we didn't know anything about going into it, and of course didn't. While we did some research and talked to people who had gone down this road before, until you've done it yourself, you don't fully understand really what you're getting into.
So you learned enough to write another book about another subject, I'll bet. All of you people out there who want to self-publish, we've got a resource on the island here.
Well, and fortunately we have a number of resources on the island. We were really grateful for help from Laurie Harrison and Greg Ewart, who had self-published Kindred Spirits about 10 years earlier, and Holly Bauer, and Sarah Eppenbach, who published With Love and Butter. So right here, very close by, we had some really experienced people who could hold our hands, and that we could learn from their experiences as well.
This really is kind of a new direction in the publishing world, isn't it?
Yes. I
know many people now who have done self-publishing, and it is an avenue to getting different kinds of work out there into the world in different ways.
Right. And the commercial publishing, or I guess that's what you would call it, the publishing world that we used to think of as who published books has changed so dramatically. And as you know, there are just a very small number of very large publishing houses now that just make the competition for having your book picked up by a publisher that much tougher, and they those businesses are much more concerned, have to be very concerned about the bottom line, And so they are, I think, much more cautious maybe than in earlier times to try unknown authors and artists. Fortunately, with changes in technology, there are just lots of other avenues for people to get their work out. And I think that because people have been willing to take that on, the self-publishing, and have been committed to producing quality books and publications, the attitude about self-published books has changed a lot as well, and there's much more respect for people who go that route too.
Well, your book, for anybody out there who hasn't seen it somewhere, it is a thing of beauty. I mean, the photographs are exquisite and compelling, and the fact that they're life size also gives them even more life. What have you found in your book tour that you've been on? Tell us a little bit about the book tour for a few minutes.
Well, I hesitate to call it a book tour that conjures up ideas of
fancy hotel rooms,
right? Being wined and dined, and someone escorting you to your reading. And Summer and I have organized all of this ourselves. But we have been making public appearances at bookstores and other venues throughout Puget Sound, mostly the northern Puget Sound, Seattle and north, since the book came out in November. And that has been a really gratifying experience for us. We developed a presentation that includes excerpts from the book. There are 23 full profiles of people. And so I read excerpts from some of those profiles, and Summer projects the images from the book on a screen so that people can listen and watch, be read to from this book. And then we always have a question and answer period. And there's just nothing better for a writer or any artist than to be able to interact with people when they're experiencing your work, encountering your work. And to have people give us comments about how touched they were by some of the stories. People often will talk about how it has reminded them of things that they're passionate about in their work or other kinds of work. And getting that kind of immediate feedback is very rewarding and something that writers often don't get. You don't get to find out or know how people are responding to your writing.
Well, because I'm in a writing group with you, I know a few of the wonderful things that people have said, but do you mind telling us a couple of the things that really stick in your mind that people have commented to you about what your book has meant to them? Or
oh, you're going to embarrass me and have me...
No, I want everybody to hear this.
Well, first of all, I'll say that without exception, what really draws people into the book are these incredible images, the photographs that Summer took. Because as you said, they are larger than life and they do tell a story. We always get comments from people about how beautiful the images are, how they really appreciate the focus on the hands, that really conveys a spirit of the work by focusing on the hands. It is different from what you would get with maybe a full body image. So we always get glowing comments about the quality of the photography, the design and the layout that just
make it such a stunning visual
really
piece.
Accentuate this beautiful work. And there have been a few times that people have commented specifically on my writing, which is always fun. And just hearing people say things like the descriptions, the imagery that I used in the writing really put them there with the person doing their work. One of the things that I felt the best about is when people have noticed, either through my reading or their own reading of the book, that I'm not in these profiles, that I'm this anonymous observer.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had several people comment about how they feel that that really does honor to the people who are profiled, because the reader is hearing about their work through their eyes and through their own words, not through my interpretation of it.
Although, because I've read all of these pieces, I know that in the profiles, you really set the scene. You describe the person. You give us a lot of sensory details so we can see where we are. We can smell what's around us. And that is one of the things that maybe people don't consciously take in, but it does give them a fully dimensional picture of the people that you're writing about.
Mm, thank you.
I think this might be a good time to hear one or two little excerpts.
Okay.
Will you tell us about what you're going to read?
Sure. I'm going to begin with just a paragraph from the introduction to the book, because it gives a little bit of background about what the whole book is about. And then I'll read a couple of excerpts from a couple of profiles. So this is where the book begins. Passion, satisfaction, connection, surprise, pure love. These aren't the words people typically use when talking about their work, but they are said over and over by the 42 people whose thoughts and images fill these pages. This book is a response to questions about what provides meaning and fulfillment in work. These stories and photographs offer insight into that mystical, awe-filled rightness that many people yearn for, but often don't feel during the long hours spent at work. Such fulfillment can be experienced in many kinds and perhaps any kind of work, but the people profiled here find it in labor with their hands. And the first excerpt I'd like to read is from the profile about the midwife. Allie Tremblay kneels silently on the floor next to a 6-foot square bathtub. Her right hand strokes the head of the pregnant woman sitting in the warm water. Then Allie squirts gel onto a turquoise stethoscope and presses it to the woman's bulging belly. A muffled, rhythmic whooshing of a heartbeat brings a smile to both women's faces. With her hands, Allie cups warm water over the woman's abdomen and crouches close to her ear. "Do whatever you need to do, Joan," Allie whispers. "You're doing great. With your next contraction, I want you to move your baby down." Joan scrunches her face, digs her chin into her chest, and grunts loudly. "Perfect," Allie says. "You're really close. That's why it's so intense." Both women and the soon-to-be father take some deep breaths. Allie, a midwife for the past 10 years, has repeated these words and actions hundreds of times. Tonight at the birth center, things are proceeding quickly. Allie hadn't expected this woman to go into labor for 2 more weeks, but when Joan arrived 15 minutes ago, she was in active labor and ready to get into the tub for a water birth. A Bach sonata plays quietly in the background. 4 rosy votive candles flicker on the windowsill. Allie rocks slowly back and forth on her knees and hums softly until another contraction begins. Joan groans louder and pushes harder. Over the next few minutes, she takes deep breaths and pushes, rests, then pushes some more. Allie says little. When she does, it's to offer soft encouragement and give simple instructions. The calm and concentration contrast with the drama unfolding. Allie is ready for the transition she is witnessing, a woman becoming a mother. Joan pushes again, her grunt turns into a bellow, and suddenly Allie's hands are catching the baby as he appears in the warm bath. In an instant, she has lifted him out of the water and placed him on his mother's chest. Allie drapes a white towel over the tiny, wrinkled, mucus-covered body and briskly rubs him dry. "Hello, baby," she says. The brand new mom whispers, "Welcome to the family," and kisses the top of her baby's head. Joan and her husband stroke their baby's cheek and watch as he struggles to open his eyes. Allie slides a miniature white cotton cap over the swirls of damp, dark hair on the baby's head and presses a tiny stethoscope to his chest. The throbbing umbilical cord is still attached, continuing to provide the newborn with oxygen. "Hi, little feet," Allie says, rubbing the soles of each with her thumbs. The baby opens his mouth and takes a deep breath, and everyone else in the birthing room does too. The next day, one of the rare ones when Allie has a break from prenatal and postpartum visits and no one is in labor, she talks about her work. "I've had a lot of jobs, but midwifery is my soul's work, my work that comes from a deeper place," she says. "I'm a licensed midwife, but I always say I catch babies, physically, spiritually, and emotionally." Throughout the process, Allie makes hundreds of observations and decisions. "It always feels like a dream when I'm in the middle of a birth. Sometimes I'm doing 10 things at once. But what I like most is sitting in that place between both worlds, where that veil is really thin, where life is coming and going." Her years of experience have taught Allie the importance of sitting and listening. "I've learned that prayer works," she says, "and that it matters what you say to women at times of vulnerability. They'll tell me that what I said changed their lives. It's usually simple things, such as, 'You're so strong, you can do this.' And I tell them they're not alone. I'm here with them."
That's lovely.
Thank you.
And what a privilege it must have been to be at that birth.
I mean, right.
To be with all the people that you interviewed.
Right.
You really were right with them with whatever they were doing.
With that one exception, with the birth, I wasn't there right at the birth. Summer was.
Oh, okay.
And took the photographs. The way Summer and I would usually operate for the interviews and the photography sessions is that we would just ask someone to do their work, and I would talk to them and ask them questions as they were doing their work, and Summer would photograph them. I knew that at a birth, I would not be able to be interviewing the midwife.
No.
During that process. The midwife had asked several of her clients who were due around the time that we were hoping to complete these interviews if they would agree to have a photographer there. And fortunately, one of those women did go into labor to meet our deadlines. But then I interviewed Allie later on and watched some films from other births that she had attended,
mm-hmm.
And then talked to her about it. So that's the one exception. All the rest of them, yes, I was right there. And it really, with all of them, it was very much a privilege to just be able to watch and listen to people talk about their work.
Will you tell us a few, just talk to us a little bit about the process of doing the interviews with the people? Did you use a tape recorder? You know, mm-hmm. How did that work?
We would contact the person that we wanted to interview and photograph and ask them if they would participate. And then we set up a time. As much as possible, Summer and I went together and met people in their workshops, their studios, farms, mechanic shops, bakeries. And as I described a moment ago, we would just ask them to go about their work. And I always went with a list of prepared questions. But as you and any interviewer knows, those are just a guide. And usually our time would go in different directions. But I did want to have a certain amount of consistency in all of these stories. And there were certain things that I really wanted to be sure that I covered with people. I did not use a tape recorder. I took notes by hand. For one thing, it seemed fitting that a book about hands, we should have as little equipment as possible, and that I should take my notes by hand. I also had a sense that people would feel more comfortable not being recorded. We just didn't have that barrier. Many people, when they're interviewed with a tape recorder, in a fairly short period of time, they do get over their nervousness of being recorded, but it is something for many people to get past. And so I didn't want to have to deal with that.
How were you able to keep up with what people were talking about?
Well, I wrote very quickly and cryptically my notes. I would have to transcribe my notes into
right
my computer
away.
Right away so that I could decipher them. But that was one of the pleasant surprises of having made a decision to work in that way, is that I found that often I would ask the person to just hold up for a minute because they had said something I wanted to be sure I got. And often what happened was, after that pause, as I was writing, then the next thing they had to say was the real gem.
Really?
Because they had had some time to reflect a little bit more or collect mm-hmm. their thoughts a little bit more. So I confess it wasn't something I went into knowing that technique would work, but it certainly did work, I felt, to all of our advantage. And it helped slow that interview process down, help people to give themselves the time to just stop and think.
Do you do that in all of your interviews then, with other pieces that you write where you interview people? Do you also do it in the same way? I'm just I'm curious because
mm-hmm, yeah.
I always use a recorder mm-hmm. when I used to interview people mm-hmm. because I didn't want to interrupt their flow,
mm-hmm.
but then I would always have to be keeping my eye on the recorder to mm-hmm. make sure that I knew when to turn it over. So,
right.
So I'm interested in people who do it the old way.
Right. Well, because I felt that it worked so well with this book, I have continued to do that. In some of the writing that I do that isn't, you know, I'm not talking to people about such deeply personal
mm-hmm.
things. Sometimes I will do interviews over the telephone, and I'm often sitting at my computer and dictating their words on the keyboard,
yeah,
instead of
notes.
My hand.
Yes.
Yeah. I can't imagine doing that face-to-face with people, although it would certainly streamline and make it easier. And I know that there have been many advances in recording equipment, and that there are lots of small tape recorders that work very well.
Mm-hmm.
I just haven't been willing to invest the time and energy into learning another, about another
yeah.
kind of technology.
Well, you've found something that works for you, so
right.
it seems like a good idea to stick with it.
Right.
I wonder if there were some surprises you encountered with this project.
There were, of course, because it was the first time I had done something like this. And I think pretty much without exception, they were all pleasant surprises.
That's good.
Summer and I knew many of the people. We knew everybody to some degree that we interviewed, and that's everybody in the book is pretty much from Puget Sound, and many of them are from Lopez Island. But one of the surprises was that even the people that we knew very well, we always learned something about them that we didn't know. And that leads to the reason for that, I think, is the biggest surprise for me in this process was realizing how rare it is that any of us talk about our work to the depth that we could do in a couple of hours of just talking to people about their work.
Mm-hmm.
And it just reminds me how in my experience, what's typical is that someone will ask you, what do you do? You maybe give a two-sentence answer or
right.
15 seconds, maybe. And then you go on to something else.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, what a wonderful experience it must have been for these people, these 23 people, to really be heard.
Right.
You know, and really be listened to.
Right. And that was something that I was grateful for. that I felt that is something that we offered to them. I was concerned that we were really asking a lot of people to spend this time with them, to ask them personal questions. We asked them to review drafts of the stories, and it felt like a big time commitment, and I was concerned that, you know, all they were going to get out of it was a book, a copy of the book. Some are also printed up a photograph for each of them, and it just seemed like so little. What we heard over and over from people, though, was how much they appreciated having the opportunity to be listened to mm-hmm. and to talk about their work, and that was a big reward for them, that I just had underestimated how that would feel.
I would think it would be a really true gift. So I congratulate you on that.
Thank you.
Maybe this would be a good time to hear another piece.
All right. Well, I would like to read next an excerpt from a piece about someone who's well known here on Lopez, but maybe people don't know this aspect of him, or not everybody does. This is called Spinner. Look at Kenny Ferrugiaro's hands, and you would guess correctly that he's a carpenter. You can tell by my hands I work a lot, Kenny says, turning his broad palms up and curling and uncurling his wide fingers. They're always cracked. There are so many wrinkles, and they're pretty strong. Kenny's hands are strong, able to easily grip 2x4s, swing hammers, and slice a saw through hunks of wood. These hands also occasionally thump the head of an African drum to beat out a rhythm for dancers or jugglers, and once a week they knead and shape dough into rustic loaves of bread. Those same hands, though, adopt a different motion and rhythm when Kenny sits at his spinning wheel, a tuft of soft carded wool between his fingers. The muscles in his forearms and wrists flex with the careful tension he applies to the fiber as he pulls and coils it into a single strand. If you looked at wool under a microscope, you'd see little burrs on the fiber. When you twist it in a certain way, it will stay. It's all in the touch, he says. Spinning wool is not something Kenny learned in the Staten Island neighborhood where he grew up. I escaped from New York right after high school and hitchhiked to California, he recalls. I lived in L.A. for 16 years, but then I realized I was done with cities. I was looking for a more rural life. He found it in the winter of 1998 in a small mountain community in western Washington. One guy there was a weaver, a gnarly, no-fuss kind of guy. He learned from his mother in Minnesota, Kenny remembers. This gnarly weaver passed his craft on to Kenny by teaching him to weave on a table loom. A year later, he started spinning. I'm always trying to find a way back to things people used to do, Kenny says. Most of Kenny's spinning has provided yarn for smaller hand-woven projects, such as scarves for his mother, father, aunts, and nieces. I like making something for somebody else, he says. I think of it as giving them a hug from afar.
That's really sweet. It was also short. How about one more little one right now before I interrogate you some more?
Okay. Well, I really want to share this excerpt from a profile about a beloved member of our community who many people know very well. This is called Painter. Watercolors of a man with bright blue eyes, white hair, and a beard are propped up on easels. The blue-eyed cat in another painting is orange. So is the real but unplugged rotary dial telephone that resides on the paint-spattered plastic drop cloth on the floor. A spiral sketchbook featuring another orange cat leans against a wall. A book sticks out from a pile of magazines and newspapers on the coffee table. Its title, Age Doesn't Matter Unless You're a Cheese. I haven't got a technique, says the woman who has painted for most of her life. I'm after color. It doesn't matter if it's chalk, pastels, acrylics. I like any color. Hildegard Goss is the living embodiment of that statement, with her snowy white hair in a topknot and her turquoise sweatshirt and navy blue sweatpants spattered with dabs of yellow, green, and red. She waves her age-spotted hands in the air as she talks. I'm trying to communicate feelings, anger, loneliness, outrage when I paint, she says. Sometimes I paint because I'm not seeing. When you paint, you start seeing more. Light, color, yellows, greens, browns that turn purple. You start to see the whole palette of colors. She goes on, "The painting is just part of your living. I paint because my paints are out there," she says, motioning to the jumble of tubes and tin cans on a folding table in front of the picture windows. Hildegard usually paints early in the day. I'm a morning person. By late afternoon, the light has changed so much. If it's dark, who has the energy to paint? But she admits, if the house is very straightened up, I'm dodging painting. When I dodge doing anything creative, I do housework. The avoidance is because you haven't quite solved the problem in your head. Most often that comes out in little driblets. What Hildegard likes most about her work is simply, as she says, the doing it, putting the paint on. She confesses, "I prefer to paint cats, dogs, animals, still lifes, not landscapes. With landscapes, I don't want to tie it down. And people? The damn fools change." The phone rings and Hildegard slowly gets up. I'm coming, she says as she shuffles to the phone in her bedroom. "Now, where were we?" she asks as she settles back into her rocking chair. "Oh, yes. Every time I do a painting, I want to do something different. Once I get started, it might come out totally different than I expected." Many aspects of Hildegard's life have turned out differently than she expected, including aging. "I think a lot of people forget they were children once," she says. "But by my age, you should have learned not to be resentful. That's part of old age learning. Take life as it is."
Those are good words of wisdom.
Right.
Coincidentally, I saw Hildegard today. She was out walking with a walker near the Hamlet house where she lives. It was just such a sweet surprise to see that indomitable little figure
right.
walking along the road.
Right. And this interview that's in the book was done when she was 89. And we concluded the piece in the book with her talking about her plans for her 90th birthday and that she already had the invitation ready and it said, "Come whether I'm dead or alive."
And that sounds like her.
We're all happy that she was very much alive for her 90th birthday and I think has just last fall celebrated her 92nd or 93rd.
I think so, yes. Well, thank you for both those lovely pieces. I'd like to go back just a little bit to when you started writing and how you came to writing. Mm-hmm. I mean, because you were a nurse for so long, and I know that your mother was a reporter.
Right.
So tell me how you came to writing.
Right. I think some of it probably was a bit by osmosis. My mom was a reporter and then the associate editor for a small town newspaper in southern Illinois, the kind of newspaper and at the time when the associate editor did just about everything. She was the reporter, she was the photographer, and she also later on worked for a weekly newspaper. When I was in high school, I worked at the newspaper proofreading and mm-hmm. counting money from the newspaper carriers. So I think that partly, you know, I was just surrounded by the world of words and people's stories. Mm-hmm. And I know that that was one of the things that my mother enjoyed most about the newspaper work that she did was when she could write feature stories and mm-hmm. and was telling people's stories. So that certainly had probably a subconscious influence. And I always did enjoy reading, and there was a lot of appreciation in my home for writing and for reading. And we all know that to be a good writer, you have to be a reader.
That's true.
And so, you know, that was now, as I look back, I think that certainly was some of the beginning. I didn't really do creative writing until about the last 15 years or so. I had done a lot of technical writing in my when I was more involved as a nurse. I worked in public health, and So much of public health is health education, and that often involved writing materials for lay people, and I did some academic writing. But that is not the same as creative writing. But it still, was an
you
avenue.
You honed your skills.
Right. And it was, I enjoyed working with words and enjoyed putting ideas into a readable form. And then...
How did you start writing your own work then?
That really began when my family and I... took some time off. We did a family sabbatical, I call it. Nobody paid us to take a sabbatical, but we did that for ourselves. And for 2 years, we lived in a very small, remote mountain community of Stehekin at the end of Lake Chelan in central Washington. And those 2 years, there were a time that I really stepped back and took a break from the nursing work that I had been so passionate about for over 20 years, and I just allowed myself to explore lots of other forms of creative expression. I wanted to share the story of what it was like living in Stehekin. Mm-hmm. There were no telephones. That was in the mid-90s. Hardly anybody at that point had email.
Or cell phones, right.
And cell phones wouldn't have worked there anyway because we were surrounded by mountains. So the way for me to communicate to friends and family that we had left behind was through letters. Mm-hmm. And that really was the beginning of... some creative writing for me about that experience. I also, of course, kept journals.
Yes.
Because that was an important time for me personally and professionally and for our family. And it was a unique experience that I really wanted to try to capture and record as much as I could. Some folks in Stehekin published a newspaper, and so I would write some personal stories for that, and then when we moved to Lopez in 1996, by that time I was clear that I had to have more balance in my life between this professional work as a nurse and some more creative expression, and that's when I really began to dedicate serious time to writing and perfecting or honing my craft and being serious about getting some of my work out in the public.
Well, because I'm in your writing group, I remember when you decided to do that, and I remember the discipline that you established that really, I think, was provided the impetus or the catalyst for you. I've seen you develop so much and grow as a writer since you developed that discipline. And I wonder if you would tell our audience, because there are a lot of people out there who would like to write some of their own stories, and I think that what you hit on is essential and key. And would you just share with people?
Sure.
What you did that worked for you?
Right. I went to a writing workshop, and it was one of those times that it just, I think, created the right atmosphere and time and space for me to develop some insights about my writing and what it meant to me, and how, for me, it has an element of being a spiritual leading and a spiritual practice as well as a creative expression. And one of the most important insights I discovered at that workshop was that I was making a living as a public health nurse consultant working independently, and so I had developed a lot of self-discipline in that work. And at that writing workshop, it dawned on me that I was devoting my best hours of the day to that consulting work. I'm a morning person, like Hildegard. And I was very responsible about my consulting work, and so I would start out the day doing that. And then, later on in the day, I had time, I would write. And of course, that often didn't happen.
Right, you get tired and distracted.
And right. And the afternoon, I know about myself, is not my most creative time either. So I really took stock of that and came to the conclusion that I could be good enough in the afternoon to do my consulting work and that I would devote my best hours of the day to my writing. And I was fortunate to be in a position that I had that kind of control over my schedule most of the time. And so I started to think of my writing as my job, even though I wasn't making a penny mm-hmm. from it. Mm-hmm. I thought about it in the same way that I did any other professional work that I have done. And I live by my calendar, and so I wrote on my calendar every day from 10 to 12, writing.
And you didn't accept meetings or right. engagements or walks or anything with people during that time. You were very, very disciplined about it.
Right.
You didn't answer the phone.
Exactly. And I told people, I'm not available. I'm at work.
Right.
Which is the way it had always been in my whole professional life when I was at a job. Mm-hmm. I wasn't available during those hours for other commitments or other mm-hmm. Opportunities. And so I thought, you know, what does this say about my commitment to writing if I don't treat it with that same kind of respect? And that was a real turning point for me. I think that was around 1999.
And it's been that long already.
Right. And it certainly is true that the only way that you get anything written is to sit in a chair and write. And that was really the beginning of me really honoring that rule as well. Another thing that I picked up at another writing conference that I keep on my desk to remind me, and I think you have one of these as well. It's a little bottle of Elmer's glue.
You gave us all a little bottle of Elmer's glue.
It's called bum glue.
Yes.
And the instructions are to apply this to your chair and sit in your chair and write.
Yes. Well, it has certainly worked for you.
Right.
Could we hear another, this is probably going to be the last one we'll hear from you, from your book. So could
yes.
we hear another selection?
Yes. Summer and I were committed to including a wide range of types of work with the hands in the book. Probably half of the people profiled are artisans, and then the other half do a range of other kinds of work. And so this next one I'll read is one of those that isn't an artisan, physical therapist. Terry Drawn helps her 83-year-old patient lie down on the treatment table and places both hands on the woman's swollen right knee. Gently but firmly, she guides the limb through a series of motions. "Now, bend your knee," she coaxes. "Good. It's good for it to do that." With her hands, sturdy forearms, and lean upper body, Terry applies resistance as her patient pushes back. "Good hamstring," she says. After several rounds of bending and straightening the knee, she offers more encouraging words. "Oh, that's much better than when you first started treatment." Terry escorts the patient back to the clinic's waiting area and then returns to the small, windowless room where she works. "I think there's a lot of knowledge in the hands, and the power of touch has always been important to me," she says, flexing the long, slender fingers of her right hand. Her left hand is dwarfed and has only the thumb and little finger, an unexplained anomaly she was born with. "Asymmetry is a big piece of the story my hands tell," she says. "Because my right hand is so dominant, sometimes I've felt that my whole body is uneven." Terry was first exposed to physical therapy when she was 10 and accompanied her older sister on home health therapy visits. She imagined herself in her sister's profession. "On some level, I understood that the people I would work with would be temporarily or permanently differently abled," she says, choosing her words with care. "I thought my difference could be useful, that I could be sensitive to that with others and help them move through their own differences." Terry's hands and touch have helped people of all ages and with varied conditions.
Now she practices in a rural health clinic, and relationships with her patients continue to gratify her. I think of my work as helping people heal and move and feel more vibrant in their lives. It's best if I have a little prayerful meditation time before I see people, she says. I need to be in the right space for the beauty of my work, the art of therapy. Some of what happens in Terry's work is a result of her knowledge and skills. Some is more of a mystery. My profession allows me to deal with people in a real way. I think that's because I physically touch them, she says. Memories are hidden away in our muscles, and the stretching evokes them. It's amazing what people entrust me with during therapy, and I think that is part of their healing. That's a sacred space to be with people.
That's really beautiful. I'd like to sum up a little bit about the book we've been talking about, the book you've just written. It was released in November by your publishing company, Heron Moon Press. It's a 144-page hardcover book, and it has been called Deep, Meaningful, and Profound by Matthew Fox, who is the author of The Reinvention of Work and Creativity, Where the Divine and the Human Meet. It's a coffee table book. It has 23 full-length profiles of people who are passionate about working with their hands. And Iris, tell us where people can race out and get copies for themselves and all their friends.
Oh, I like that idea of them racing out to get copies. For our local listeners, you can always get a copy of the book directly from Summer or me by calling us, or you can order it from our website, which is www.handsworking.com, and we have a PayPal option set up there. A number of local places on the island have been very supportive. Phyllis Potter at Isle Haven Books has been a great promoter of the book and carries Hands at Work at her bookstore. It's also available at Chimera Gallery, the artist cooperative gallery in the village. Joyce Briner at Vita's has copies of the book there. Hers is one of the profiles in the book, and she enthusiastically offered to have the book available at Vita's. So those are places right here on Lopez. For people who have friends and family in other places, there are many bookstores and gift shops and galleries in the islands. All the island bookstores carry Hands at Work, and then several places, bookstores, Seattle, Mount Vernon, Bellingham. So there are lots of places people can get their own copies or have friends and family get them.
Good, and I hope that they will, because I know nobody will be disappointed. You've been listening to the Lopez Writers Read program on KLOI FM 102.9. This was our first show featuring Iris Gravel. It's pre-recorded in April. I want to thank you very much for joining us, and hope you'll tune in again soon.